to Idris. James? The voice was silent, an echo in his head. He knew who it was instantly, of course. Only silent brothers spoke this way, and he would never mistake Jem for anyone else. James, might I have a word with you? James glanced up to see Jem, tall and dark in his parchment-coloured robes, leaving the infirmary. Setting the bandages down, he slipped out the door and into the corridor outside. He followed his uncle to the music room, neither of them speaking as they went. The corridors of the Institute had been redesigned by Tessa some years ago, the dark Victorian wallpaper gone in favour of light paint and true stone. Elegant carved sconces emerged from the walls at spaced intervals. Each was in the shape of the symbol of a shadow hunter family. Carstairs, Carr, Herondale, Rayburn, Starkweather, Lightwood, Blackthorn, Monteverdi, Rosales, Bellfleur. It was James's mother's way of saying that they were all shadow hunters together, all with an equal place in the Institute. Not that the Clave had always treated his mother as if she were equal, James thought. He pushed the thought away, the whispers about his mother, himself, and Lucy always made his blood boil. The music room was rarely used. Lucy was not musical at all, and James had played the piano for a few years and then abandoned it. Golden sunlight poured through the windows, illuminating dancing trails of dust motes. A grand piano loomed in the corner, half covered by a white drop cloth. Jem's violin had pride of place. A Stradivarius carved of mellow wood, it rested in an open case atop a high table. James had seen his father come into the room just to touch the violin sometimes, a faraway look in his eyes. He wondered if he would do the same with Matthew's belongings if, one day, he lost his parapetai. He pushed the thought away. Matthew was like food, sleep, breathing. Doing without him would not be possible. I got your message, Jem said. The one you sent last night. James started. I had nearly forgotten. He could see himself in a gold-framed mirror on the wall. There was grass in his hair and a bloody scratch on his cheek. He looked like an escapee from Bedlam. I'm not sure it matters now. It might, Jem said. He seemed tense. If one could ever describe a silent brother as tense. Barbara was still conscious when I arrived here. She whispered to me of you. Of me? James was startled. She said, James must be protected. Did you turn into a shadow at the lake? No, James said. I saw the shadow realm last night and again today, but I did not become a shadow myself. I was able to control it. Jem relaxed minutely. James, he said, you know that I have been trying to discover which greater demon your grandfather was. Your ability. It's not an ability, James said. It's a curse. It is not a curse. Jem's tone was sharp. It is not a curse any more than the magic warlocks do is a curse. Or the ability your mother has is a curse. You have always said it is dangerous, said James. Some gifts are dangerous, and it is a gift, though it may come from the bloodline of fallen angels. A gift I cannot use for anything, James said. Last night, at the party when I slipped into darkness, I saw Barbara pulled to the ground by a shadow. Then today at the lake she was dragged to earth by a demon with its teeth in her leg. He set his jaw. I don't know what it means, nor did the visions help me or allow me to help Barbara or the others. He hesitated. Perhaps if we went back to the lessons, we could learn more about the shadow realm, whether it is perhaps trying to give me some sort of sign. It would be wise for us to continue the lessons, yes. Jem said, but we cannot begin now. The poison consuming those who were attacked is like nothing I have ever seen, nor do the other brothers know it. We must bend all our will now to finding the cure. The door opened and Will stuck his head into the music room. He looked weary, his shirt sleeves rolled to the elbow, his shirt stained with tinctures and salve. Still, he smiled when he saw James and Jem. Is everything all right? Uncle Jem was worried about me, said James, but I am quite well. Will came up to his son and pulled him into a quick, rough hug. He said, I am glad to hear it, Jamie Bach. Gideon and Sophie have arrived, and to see them with Barbara. He kissed the top of James's head. It does not bear thinking of. I should return to the infirmary, said Jem. There is still much for me to do. Will nodded, releasing James. I know Gideon and Sophie will feel better if you were the one tending Barbara. Not to insult Brother Shadrach, who I'm sure is an excellent and well-respected member of the Brotherhood. Jem shook his head, which was as close as he got to smiling, and the three of them left the music room. To James's surprise, Thomas was waiting in the corridor outside, looking hollow-eyed. Will exchanged a quick glance with James and left his son alone with Thomas. It was good, James thought, to have a father who understood the significance of friendship. Thomas spoke as soon as the adults were out of earshot. My parents are here, he said in a low voice. James, I need something to do. Something that might help my sister. I think I might go mad otherwise. Of course. We must all help Barbara, said James. Thomas, in the park, Barbara saw the demons before everyone else. She was the one who warned me. She had perfect sight even before she got her voyance rune, Thomas said. Perhaps because my mother was a sighted mundane before she became a shadow hunter. We've never been sure. Barbara wasn't terribly interested in testing her abilities, but she always had unusually keen senses. It is almost as if she could glimpse my shadow realm, James murmured, remembering what Barbara had said, that she had been able to see ragged black shapes at the ball, that she had felt herself drawn down. An idea had begun to take shape in his mind. He wondered if he should go back and speak of it to Jem, but no, Jem would never let him do it. He would think it too dangerous, reckless even. But James was feeling reckless, and from the look of it, Thomas was too. We need to round up Matthew and Christopher, James said. I have an idea of what we can do. Some of the colour came back to Thomas's face. Christopher has just returned from Chiswick, he said. I saw him in the entry hall. But as for Matthew... Cordelia had determined to make herself useful in the infirmary. It was the only way she could be sure she wouldn't be tossed out on her ear. After all, none of the wounded were her relatives or even her friends, and she wasn't likely to be making many new friends at this rate. Lucy had been recruited for duty as well. Dozens of labelled jars and pots had been taken down from the cupboards behind the marble-topped counter, where Tessa was presiding over the dispensing of ingredients for tinctures and potions. Cordelia's own hands had been slathered in salve and wrapped in bandages. They looked like white paws as she handled the mortar and pestle she'd been given. The front of the infirmary was taken up with those who had scratches, sprains, and burns. The tinctures and salves were mostly for them. Lucy was busy handing them out, her cheerful flow of chatter audible over the low hum of other conversation. A screen had been pulled in front of the far end of the room, and Cordelia was almost glad for it. It was too awful to see Sophie and Gideon Lightwood break down by Barbara's bedside, or even Rosamond sitting silently by her brother. Cordelia was sorry she had ever harboured uncharitable thoughts towards the Wentworths. No one deserved this. It's all right. Tessa's voice was gentle. James's mother was busy finely chopping mugwort into a bowl. She cast a sympathetic glance at Cordelia. I have seen the Silent Brothers bring people back from much worse. Cordelia shook her head. I have not. I suppose I have been very sheltered. We all have been, for a time, said Tessa. The natural state of shadow hunters is battle. When it is always ongoing, there is no time to stop and think that this is not an ideal condition for happiness. Shadow hunters are not suited to a halcyon state, yet we have had that time for the past decade or so. Perhaps we have begun to think ourselves invincible. People are only invincible in books, said Cordelia. I think you will find most of the time not even then, said Tessa. But at least we can always pick up a book and read it anew. Stories offer 1,000 fresh starts. It was true, Cordelia thought. She had read the story of Leila and Majnun 1,000 times, and each time the beginning was a thrill, even though she knew and dreaded the end. The only equivalent in real life is memory, Tessa said, looking up as Will Herondale came into the room, followed by Cousin Jem. But memories can be bitter as well as sweet. Will smiled at his wife. James's parents always looked at each other with such love, it was nearly painful to see, before heading toward the small group of Lightwoods gathered around Barbara. Cordelia heard them greet him, and Sophie's worried tones, but her gaze was on Jem. He had come toward the counter and was reaching for several jars of mixed herbs. It was now or never.
Cousin Jem, Cordelia whispered, I need to speak with you.
Jem glanced up in surprise. Cordelia tried not to start. It was always strange to see a silent brother this close. She remembered all the times her mother had suggested her father go to the Basilius, the Shadow Hunter Hospital in Alicante, to cure his lingering illness. Elias had always insisted he did not wish to go anywhere where he would be surrounded by silent brothers. They rattled his nerves, he claimed. Most of them were like creatures of ice and blood. Ivory robes marked in red, skin drained of colour, scarred with red runes. Most were without hair, and worse, had their eyes sewn shut, their sockets sunken and hollow. Jem did not look like that. His face was young and very still, like the face of a knight from the Crusades carved on a marble tomb. His hair was a tangle of black and white threads. His eyes were permanently shut, as if in prayer. Are you all right, Cordelia? Asked Jem's voice in her mind. Tessa immediately moved to shield the two of them from the gaze of the rest of the sick room. Cordelia tried to appear as if she was absolutely fascinated with her mortar and pestle, energetically mashing together feverfew and golden seal.
Please, she whispered. Have you seen Baba, my father, in Idris? How is he? When can he come home?
There was a long pause. I have seen him, said Cousin Jem. For a moment, Cordelia let herself remember her father, truly remember him. Her father had taught her to fight. Her father had his faults, but he was never cruel. And when he did pay Cordelia some mind, his attention made her feel 10 feet tall. It often felt as though Alistair and Sonar were made of different stuff than Cordelia, glass or metal with edges that could cut, but Elias was the one who was like her. Memories can be bitter as well as sweet. She murmured,
You are a silent brother. I know my father was not always welcoming to you.
Never think I am resentful of the distance he kept, said Jem. I would do anything I could for you and our family.
He wrote me a note, asking me to believe in him. He says he is not responsible for what happened. Can't you make the Clave believe him too?
There was a long pause. I cannot assure the Clave of what I do not know myself, said Jem.
They must ask him what happened, said Cordelia. They must try the mortal sword. Will they?
Jem hesitated. Cordelia saw that Lucy was approaching them, just as she realized she had mashed the herbs in the mortar into green sludge.
Daisy,
Lucy said in a low voice. This struck Cordelia as alarming. Lucy could rarely be convinced to whisper about anything.
Could you come with me a moment? I very much need your assistance.
Of course, Cordelia said a bit hesitantly. It is only that... She turned toward Jem, hoping to get his answer to her question, but he had already vanished into the crowded sickroom.
Where are we going?
Cordelia whispered as they hurried along the corridors of the Institute.
Lucy, you cannot simply abduct me, you know.
Nonsense, said Lucy. If I wished to abduct you, you can be sure that I would do it quite expertly, no doubt beneath the veil of silence and darkness. They had reached the vestibule. Lucy took down a cloak from a peg on the wall and handed another to Cordelia. Besides, I told my father I was taking you home in the carriage because you faint at the sight of blood.
Lucy!
Cordelia followed her friend out into the courtyard. The sun had only just set, and the evening was brushed with a steel-blue patina. The yard was crowded with carriages, each bearing the crest of a shadow hunter family.
Not every bit of a good story is true, said Lucy.
Her cheeks were bright pink. The air had become chill. Cordelia pulled her cloak around her.
It's the story that's important. I don't want to go home, though,
Cordelia pointed out, as she and Lucy wove their way through the crowd of carriages. She squinted.
Is someone singing inside the Baybrook carriage?
Lucy waved a dismissive hand.
Of course you're not going home. You're coming with me on an adventure.
She waved at something half hidden behind the Wentworth carriage.
Bridget!
It was indeed Bridget, her greying red hair wound into a chignon, having clearly just finished readying the Institute's broom and a fresh horse, Balios's brother Xanthos. The two were a matched pair. Cordelia had heard a great deal about them growing up. Lucy went instantly to pat Xanthos's soft, white-speckled nose. Cordelia tried to smile at Bridget, who was eyeing them both suspiciously.
Carriage all ready for you, Miss Baggage, Bridget said to Lucy. Try not to get in trouble. It fusses your parents.
I'm just taking Cordelia home, Lucy said, blinking innocently.
Bridget wandered off, muttering about finding certain people stuck in certain trees while sneaking out of certain windows. Lucy bent to whisper something in Xanthos's ear before gesturing for Cordelia to join her in the carriage.
It's all glamoured, she explained,
as the broom rattled under the open gate and into the streets of London.
It would just upset the mundanes to see a carriage racing about with no driver.
So the horse knows where to take us? Cordelia settled back against the upholstered bench seat.
But it's not to Cornwall Gardens.
Lucy shook her head.
Balios and Xanthos are special horses, and we're going to Chiswick House.
Cordelia stared.
Chiswick House? We're going to see Grace and Tatiana. Oh, Lucy, I don't know.
Lucy held up a hand.
There could be a time, a short time, during which you may have to distract them. But it is not a social call. I am on a mission.
Cordelia did not think Grace seemed the sort of person who could easily be distracted.
I shan't, she said firmly. Not unless you tell me what this mission is.
Lucy was silent for a moment, her face small and pale in the shadows of the carriage.
You know, I can see ghosts, she said, and hesitated.
Cordelia blinked. It was the last thing she'd expected Lucy to say. Ghosts were something all shadow hunters knew existed, and when ghosts wanted to be seen, most Nephilim could see them. But the Herondales had a special ability. Will, James, and Lucy could all see ghosts that didn't want to be seen.
Yes, but what? A ghost told me.
Lucy broke off for a moment.
Jessamine told me there is a ghost at Chiswick House that might know about these daylight demons, she said at last. Daisy, I have to do something for Barbara and the others. I cannot just sit about passing out tinctures. If there is anything I can do to help, I must do it.
Of course, but why not tell your father or your mother?
They would surely understand. I do not wish to raise hopes that may come to nothing, said Lucy. Besides, they might feel they needed to tell some of the others, and I have been told that being sought out by ghosts is not an appealing trait in a young woman. Cordelia caught at Lucy's hand with her own bandaged one. Tell me who said that to you. I will kill them. Lucy sniffled and then laughed. You needn't kill anyone. Just come with me to Chiswick, and I will be perfectly satisfied.
We must bar the doors, said James. They don't lock, and we can't be interrupted. He frowned. Matthew, can you stand? The ballroom had been closed up after the ball. It was rarely used except for social functions. The room was warm and close as James, Christopher, and Thomas threw off their jackets and stripped down to shirt sleeves. Most were still wearing the same weapon belts they'd had on in the park. James had added several new daggers to his own. Only Matthew was unarmed. Blinking and dishevelled, he found his way to a plushly upholstered chair and fell into it. I am quite all right, he said, waving an airy hand. Please continue with your plan. He squinted. What was your plan? I'll tell you in a moment, James said. He was quite sure none of them were going to like it. Thomas? Thomas nodded, seized hold of a heavy sideboard, and began to shove it in front of the ballroom doors. Christopher looked worriedly at Matthew. Perhaps some water? He said. I am quite all right, Matthew repeated. I found you drinking from a flask and singing Elsie from Chelsea in the Baybrook's carriage, said Thomas darkly. It was private there, said Matthew, and well upholstered. At least it wasn't the Bridgestocks' carriage, because they have already experienced enough tragedy today. Nothing bad has happened to the Baybrooks, said Christopher with great sincerity. Nothing until now, said James. Christopher, was everything all right, dropping off Miss Blackthorne? He tried not to sound as if he were too invested in the answer. Matthew raised an eyebrow but said nothing. Oh, perfectly, said Christopher. I told her all about culturing bacteria, and she was so fascinated that she never spoke a word. James had gone to pile chairs in front of the doors to the withdrawing room. He hoped Grace had not expired from boredom. Did you have to tell Mrs. Blackthorne what had happened at the park? She can't have been pleased. Christopher shook his head. I confess I didn't see her. Miss Blackthorne asked that I drop her at the gates, not the front door. She probably doesn't want anyone to see the state of the place, said Matthew, yawning. The gates alone are festooned in rust. James eyed him. Thomas, he said in a low voice. Maybe a healing rune? Thomas nodded and approached Matthew cautiously, as one might approach a stray cat on the street. Some time ago, James had discovered that healing runes sobered Matthew up. Not entirely, but enough. Push up your sleeve, then, there's a good fellow, Thomas said, seating himself on the arm of Matthew's chair. Let's wake you up, and James can tell us whatever mad thing he has planned. Done with the chairs, James cast a glance around the room, dusted off his hands and said, We'd better check the locks on all the windows, just to be sure. It seems somehow blasphemous to use marks to rid oneself of the effects of alcohol, Matthew added, as Thomas put his steely away. The mark in question gleamed, new made, on Matthew's wrist. He looked already more clear-eyed, and less as if he were about to fall asleep or be sick. I've seen you use your steely to part your hair, said James dryly, as he began to examine the window locks. The angel gave me this hair, replied Matthew. It's one of the shadow hunter's gifts, like the mortal sword. Now that is blasphemy, said Thomas. Christopher had joined James in checking the window fastenings, though James desperately wished he could open one and get some air into the room. A thing of beauty is a joy forever, Thomas, said Matthew. James, why are we locking all the windows? Are we afraid of over-curious pigeons? James slammed a bolt home and turned to look at the others. I have spent the past 4 years of my life trying to train myself not to do what I am about to do. I don't wish to even consider the possibility of being interrupted.
By a pigeon? Said Matthew.
But the look in his eyes was sympathetic, despite his lightly mocking words. Jamie, what are we doing here? James took a deep breath. I am going to deliberately send myself into the Shadow Realm, he said. The Merry Thieves exploded in a chorus of protest. Matthew stood up, his eyes glittering.
Certainly not, he said. The danger!
I do not think there will be danger, said James. I have been in and out of the Shadow Realm many times in my life. It has been ages since I fell accidentally into that world. Yet in the past week, I have seen it 3 times, once just before the attack today. I cannot think that is a coincidence. If I can use this ability to help Barbara, Ariadne, all of us, you must let me do it.
Bloody hell.
Matthew rubbed at his eyes. If we don't help you here, you'll just try to do this after we've all gone, won't you? Clearly, said James. He tapped the daggers at his waist. I'm armed, at least. Matthew twisted the signet ring on his finger, marked with MF. It had been a gift from James when they had become Parabatai, and he tended to fiddle with it only when distressed. Very well, James. As you wish. James cleared his throat. All right, let's get on with it. He was met with the gaze of 6 expectant eyes.
Well,
Thomas said hopefully after a long pause, go on into the Shadow Realm then. James concentrated. He stared at the blank floor and tried to conjure up images in his mind of the Shadow Realm. The scorched grey sky and dimmed sun. He imagined the ballroom wrong, the windows set oddly into the walls, the chandeliers melting and sagging. He opened his eyes and yelled. A pair of eyes were staring directly into his, so close that he could make out the details inside the green irises, the faint splotches of brown and black.
Matthew!
I really don't think staring at him is going to help, Matthew, said Thomas, and Matthew took a reluctant step back from his parapetai.
Jamie, is there anything that might help you begin the process? We've all seen you do it. You start to get shadowy and turn a bit blurry around the edges.
When I go into the Shadow Realm, the realness of my presence here begins to fade, James said. He did not mention that in the past he had faded enough in this world to pass through a solid wall. He did not intend to do it again.
But it is not what drives me into the Shadow Realm. More of a side effect of being there.
Often it happens when you are upset or shocked, said Christopher.
I suppose we could try upsetting or shocking you.
Given everything that's happened, that shouldn't be too hard, said James.
Nonsense, said Matthew, hopping up on a nearby occasional table.
It was quite frail looking, with thin gold-painted wooden legs, and James eyed it worriedly.
The last time I saw you shocked was when that Iblis demon was sending Christopher love letters.
I have a dark charm, said Christopher sadly.
Please recall that I am the pale neurasthenic one, and you are the stern heroic one, Matthew said to James. It is very tedious when you mix up our roles. We will have to think of something quite impressive to startle you.
So what is my role? Said Christopher.
Mad inventor, of course, said Matthew promptly. And Thomas is the one with a good heart.
Lord, I sound dull, said Thomas.
Look, James, come here for a second.
James moved toward Thomas, who seemed to have decided on something. In moments like this, he looked very like his mother, with her brilliant hazel eyes and ferocious mouth. A fist came sailing out of the air and landed squarely in James's solar plexus. He went flying backward, hitting the floor with a gasp. His head swam. Matthew dropped down by his side as James heaved himself up onto his elbows, gasping. The pain wasn't bad, but the feeling of trying to catch his breath was sickening.
Thomas, Matthew yelled. What were you trying to...
I was trying to surprise him,
Thomas yelled back. This is important, Matthew.
He darted a worried look at James, belying his angry words. You don't mind, do you, Jamie?
It's all right, James said breathlessly. Only it didn't work. If I turned into a shadow every time something hit me, I couldn't patrol.
He stared up at the ceiling, which had mirrors on it. He could see himself lying splayed on the parquet, hair very black against the white, Matthew kneeling over him like a squire over the body of a dead knight. He could see Christopher and Thomas in the mirror as well, or at least the tops of their heads. Christopher was reaching up to pull something down from the wall. Thomas had his arms crossed. Matthew jumped to his feet with the agility of a fox and held out a hand to help James up after him. James had only just regained his footing when an arrow shot past his head. One of the windows shattered, and Matthew threw himself against James. They tumbled to the floor again, knocking the breath out of James for the second time in 5 minutes. He rolled into a sitting position, shouldering Matthew aside, to find Thomas goggling at Christopher, who was clutching one of the bows that had been hanging on the wall. In case anyone was wondering if those were purely ornamental, said James, getting to his feet, they are not.
In the name of a million bloody angels, Christopher, what the hell did you just do?
Matthew demanded, leaping up after James.
Did you try to kill James?
Christopher lowered the bow. James thought he could hear noises in the Institute, doors slamming in the distance and running feet. Bloody hell.
I was not trying to kill James, said Christopher in an injured tone. I was hoping the shock of the arrow flying past would startle him into the shadow realm. Pity it didn't work.
We must think of a new plan to grievously alarm James at once.
Christopher, James exclaimed, I cannot believe you would say that. I also cannot believe you would shoot at me. It had a 72% chance of working, in perfect laboratory conditions. We are not in perfect laboratory conditions, James shouted. We are in the ballroom of my house.
At that moment, the doors of the ballroom rattled.
What's going on?
It was Will's voice.
James, are you in there?
Bloody hell, my father,
James said, casting about.
Look, all of you get out through the windows. Well, the broken one anyway. I'll take the blame. I'll say I shot the window out.
In the ballroom, Thomas said practically.
Why would you do such a rattle-headed thing? I'm capable of anything.
James made a grab for Christopher's bow. Christopher ran around behind Thomas as if his friend were a maypole.
Come on, Kit, give it over.
Thomas rolled his eyes.
He's going to say, because I'm a Herondale, isn't he?
The pounding on the door increased. James turned his fiercest glare on the others.
I am a Herondale, he said. And I am telling you to get out of my institute, so the only one who gets punished here is me. Answer me, James, Will shouted. Why have you blocked this door? I demand to know what's going on. James isn't here, Matthew called, moving closer to him. Go away!
James looked at Matthew, puzzled.
Really? I heard breaking glass, Will called. I was practicing fighting moves, Matthew answered. In the ballroom? We're trying to distract Thomas. It's been a very emotional day, Matthew shouted back. What?
Will's voice was incredulous.
Don't you blame this on me, Thomas whispered. James.
Matthew put his hands on James's shoulders and turned James toward him. Now that the window of the ballroom was shattered, cooler air came in, lifting Matthew's sweat-dampened hair off his forehead. His eyes were intent, black in the dimness, fixed on James. James found himself startling at the seriousness of Matthew's gaze.
If you're going to do this, you need to do it now.
I know, James said. Math, help me. It was an old nickname for Matthew, given to him by Will, after the Welsh king, Math Ap Mathanwy, the keeper of all wisdom and knower of all things.
Will always said Matthew had been born knowing too much. There was a dark awareness in his gaze now, as he leaned in toward James's ear.
Jamie, he whispered, I'm sorry to have to do this.
He swallowed.
You are cursed, a child of demons. It is why you can see the shadow realm. You are seeing the place you belong.
James jerked back, staring at Matthew. Matthew, who smelled of brandy and familiarity. Matthew, who could be cruel, but never to James.
James's vision began to slide into greyness. Matthew went white.
James, he said, I didn't mean it. But James could no longer feel Matthew's hands on his shoulders. He could no longer feel the ballroom floor under his feet. The doors of the ballroom were beginning to crack open, but he could no longer hear them. The world had gone monochrome. James saw broken black walls, a splintered floor, and dust that glittered like dull jewels scattered across the place where Barbara had fallen. He bent to reach for it, as the universe jerked beneath his feet, and he was thrust forward into nothingness.
Days passed. Idris, 1900.
James was just over the scalding fever, reunited with his family in the bright meadows and cool forests of Idris. And yet he felt uneasy as he opened the windows in his bedroom at Herondale Manor, bringing fresh air to the room for the first time in months. Perhaps it was how quickly one travelled, through portals. He had only just been waving goodbye to Cordelia and her parents, and feeling about Cordelia in a manner that he could not possibly put into words. It was so excellent, and strange, and perplexing. He could have used several days at sea, or aboard a train to gaze out at the landscape and feel complicated things. Instead, 10 minutes after being at Cirrenworth, he was pulling protective sheets off furniture and lighting witch lights, and his father was loudly proclaiming the healing quality of the Idris air. James was unpacking his things when his mother came into the bedroom, sorting through correspondence. She held out a small envelope.
One for you, she said, and left him in privacy with the letter.
James didn't recognize the handwriting. It was in a refined, feminine hand. He briefly thought, but I don't know anyone in Idris to send me a letter. And then he realized, Grace. He sat on the bed to read it. All it said was, meet me at our place, tomorrow, dusk. Yours, GB. He felt a bit guilty. He had not thought of Grace in a time. He wondered if she had done anything this past year and, with a start, realized it was plausible that she had gone nowhere and talked to nobody. Tatiana Blackthorn was notorious for avoiding all Shadow Hunter society, and especially with the Herondales not in residence, she had very few neighbours, and those some distance away.
By the angel, he thought, am I Grace's only friend?
I have no one else. No, Grace said.
They sat together on the forest floor, James leaning against a high, looping oak root, and Grace upon a stone. Grace's look of sorrow turned quickly back to her usual calm composure.
I have no news to report since our last meeting, I fear, she said.
But you look as though you have battled against something. More than tired.
Oh, said James. Well, that is one thing that has happened to me since I last saw you. I'm just getting over scalding fever, I'm afraid.
Grace mock flinched away, then laughed.
No, I've had it, don't worry. My poor James. I do hope you weren't lonely.
I was lucky there, said James.
He felt a slight twinge in the pit of his stomach, for no reason he understood. Cordelia and her mother had both had it, so they could stay. They took good care of me, Cordelia especially. It really made the situation much more tolerable, much less bad than it could have been, if she had not been there. Even James understood that he was rambling a bit.
Grace only nodded. The next day, James woke late to find his parents already out and his sister perched on one of the overstuffed armchairs in the parlour, scribbling furiously into a notebook. "Do you want to do something?" he asked Lucy. Without looking up, she said, "I am doing something. I'm writing."
"What are you writing about?"
"Well, if you don't leave me alone, I'll write about you." So, with nothing else to do, he walked to Blackthorn Manor. The manor looked, to his eyes, identical to how it had appeared the first time he'd gone there a year ago, to cut the briars from the gates. The house itself was closed and silent, like a giant bat curled into itself to sleep through the day, until the darkness gave it leave to unfurl its wings again. If anything, the briars were longer than they had been when he first began his work last year, the thorns more numerous, longer, and sharper. The first half of the motto above the gates was obscured, and all that could be read now was Lex Nulla. He walked the perimeter, around the stone wall, through the uncut underbrush. He felt silly. He hadn't brought a book or a sword or anything to do. When he came again to the front gates, though, Grace was waiting behind them.
"I could see you through my bedroom window," Grace said without preamble. "You looked lost."
"Good morning," James said, and Grace smiled at his manners. "Do you think your mother would want me to trim the briars up again?" An awkward silence fell. Then Grace said,
"I cannot imagine that my mother would mind if the vines were to be cleaned up. If I fetched you shears and you cut them back from the gates, I would keep you company."
"That seems a fine bargain," said James with a grin.
"I cannot promise to make enough idle conversation to fill the time, of course," Grace added. "I could read to you, if you like."
No, thank you," he said quickly. Grace looked surprised, so James added, "I would rather hear about your life."
"My life is this house," she said.
"Then," he said, "tell me about the house." So she did. James never told his parents where he was going. He would simply leave the house in the afternoon, trim the vines and overgrowth outside the walls of the manor, and talk with Grace for 2 hours or so, before growing tired and thirsty, begging Grace's pardon, and sauntering home. Grace told him of the manor's grandeur and the layers of dust and neglect that had overtaken it.
"Sometimes I feel I live in a giant cobweb, but my mother doesn't trust anyone to come and clean, and the place is too big for any two people to keep up."
She told him of the twisting thorns carved into the oak banister, the coat of arms above the mantel, the frightening metal statue lurking on the second floor. Her description sounded dreadful to James, like the house was a carcass, once a beautiful living thing, rotting away. The thought made him shiver. But when he returned home, the feeling faded. At night, he still fell asleep to his memory of Cordelia's voice, low and steady in his ear. Lucy announced she planned to read to James from her work in progress, Secret Princess Lucy is Rescued from Her Terrible Family. James listened with a carefully arranged look of interest, even though he was subjected to endless tales of cruel Prince James and his many awful deeds. "I think that cruel Prince James has been somewhat boxed in by his name," James offered at one point. Lucy informed him that she wasn't looking for critique at this stage in the creative process.
"Secret Princess Lucy only wishes to be kind, but cruel Prince James is driven to cruelty because he simply cannot stand to see Princess Lucy best him again and again in every domain," said Lucy.
"I'm going to go now," said James. Lucy closed the notebook and looked at James.
"What's she like, Grace Blackthorn? You see her sometimes when you're over there cutting the briars, don't you?"
"I suppose." James was caught off guard. "She's sad. She's terribly lonely, I think. All she knows is her mother and their creepy house."
"How awful for her."
"Yes. It is awful. She is truly to be pitied."
Indeed, said Lucy.
At their spot in the forest, James told Grace about the friends he'd made. Matthew, who Grace knew was the consul's son, and Thomas and Christopher, who he referred to as your cousins, to no reaction from Grace. She only said shyly,
I must say that I am a little glad that they are not here with you and Idris. Oh, I am sure you would be having a grander time if they were, but then we would not have all this time together, and I would miss it.
James worried about Grace. It would not do for him to be her only friend. There was only so often he could see her. He thought of Cordelia's visit later in the summer and whether there would be any possibility that they could meet, given that his friendship with Grace must remain a secret. Now Grace appeared to hesitate.
Would I offend you if I asked what happened to you at Shadowhunter Academy? I have heard only rumours.
James told her about his strange power of passing into shadow, it having been revealed before a good portion of the academy, and his expulsion. It is hardly a secret, he said, wondering why it felt like a great confession. It is because of my mother being a sort of warlock. Everyone knows it, yet still they mutter and point.
It often seems to me, she said, that warlocks are great partners to us in fighting demons, and they are themselves partly demonic. I do not see why others must fuss so.
Shadowhunters don't like difference, James said. They always see evil in it. But here, I have told you a secret, and now you must tell me one. Grace smiled.
I have no secrets.
Not true. Where do you come from, Grace Blackthorn? Do you remember your parents?
Yes, she said. I was 8 when they were killed by demons. I would have been left by myself had it not been for Mama.
That did explain why Grace had only a single rune on her left hand. The Voyance rune was the first mark Shadowhunters received when they were children. Tatiana had clearly not welcomed the idea of Grace continuing her Shadowhunter education further. You would have been taken in by an institute, said James. Shadowhunters don't abandon their own.
I suppose, said Grace, but I wouldn't have had a family. And now I do. A mother, and a family name, and a home.
She did not look entirely happy about it.
I do wish I had been able to keep something of my parents, though.
James was startled.
Do you truly possess nothing of theirs? There is one thing, she said. My mother had a silver bracelet she wore. Mama said it is very valuable and she keeps it in a box in her study. She says she will let me wear it when I am older, but every year I ask, and every year I am not yet old enough.
Can you not retrieve it from its box?
The box is locked up tight, she said. My mother is fond of locks. All over the house I find drawers, cupboards, boxes that won't budge without the right keys. I cannot imagine that Mama remembers what key goes to what lock. There are so many of each.
Her expression changed in a subtle way.
But enough of this sorrowful subject. I have heard from my mother that the Carstairs family will be visiting you later this summer. No doubt you will spend all your time with them once they get here.
No, James said. I expect Cordelia will want to spend all her time with Lucy. They're to be parabatai someday. Of course, Lucy is also writing her book, so there may well be times when I really should spend time with Cordelia as a good host. I mean, whatever she likes. Obviously, if she wanted to spend every day with me, that would be all right. He stopped, realizing that he had become entirely crazed sometime in the past 10 seconds. Grace was being very polite about it. I'm so sorry, he said. I did not mean to suggest.
Grace laughed lightly. Nonsense. I know you mean well, James. You're just in love with Cordelia.
James was horrified. I am fond of her, that is all. We are friends, as you and I are.
Oh, Grace said. And if she arrives here in Idris and tells you she has met the most wonderful man, and they have had a whirlwind romance and now they are promised to each other, you would only congratulate her, like you would any of your friends?
I would tell her she was too young to get married, James said stiffly.
The truth was that when he thought of Cordelia marrying someone else, it felt like being kicked in the heart. With a start, he realized that in his vague imaginings of the future, Cordelia had always been there, a steady, welcome presence, a warm light in the dark of the unknown.
Cruel Prince James strode into the chamber, his cape flashing behind him and his terrible, terrible moustache askew with rage.
Lucy narrated the moment James walked through the door. Does it need to be said twice that it's terrible? James said.
He required a hot beverage to soothe his throat, parched from barking out his wicked commands all day. Tea, he thought, yes, tea and revenge.
I'll just go put the kettle on, James sighed.
What a strange sort of friendship we have, Grace said.
They were back at Blackthorn Manor, James clipping away at the briars along the high stone wall, and Grace on the other side, ambling along with him. He caught glimpses of her every once in a while as they walked through gaps in the stone.
It's a pity you can't turn into a shadow and come join me, on my side of the wall.
James stopped clipping. I hadn't thought of that. Maybe I could. He put down the shears in the grass and looked at his hands. He did not know what to do. He thought hard of nothingness, of the grey of the shadow realm. With a start, he stumbled forward through the wall. He recovered himself. He was still a shadow, though he was not in the shadow realm. He stood very clearly inside the garden walls of Blackthorn Manor. There was overgrown grass everywhere, and Grace staring at him.
Can you come back?
She was mouthing, or possibly saying out loud, and James, with a huge effort, did. Back in his physical form, he clenched and unclenched his fists.
That was amazing, Grace said. I imagine you'd get used to the feeling if you practiced.
Maybe. Do you think I could leave by the gate? Grace laughed. At the gate, as he departed, she reached for his arm.
Wait, James, I was thinking. If some night you find yourself unable to sleep and you find yourself cast into shadow, perhaps you could come here and walk through the briars and into the house and into Mama's study and dip your shadowed hand through the top of the right box and retrieve my bracelet for me.
James felt a surge of warmth toward Grace. He had feared she might be horrified by his presence as a shadow, but not only did she accept him, she presented an opportunity for his power to be used to help. He felt for some reason that he owed her, though he could not have said why. I could. I will.
Leave me a sign if you do it, Grace said, and the next night I will meet you in the forest. You would be a true friend to me if you could do this.
I can, said James. I will.
Six. No more of mirth. All within is dark as night, in the windows is no light, and no murmur at the door, so frequent on its hinge before. Close the door, the shutters close, or through the windows we shall see the nakedness and vacancy of the dark deserted house. Come away. No more of mirth is here, or merrymaking sound. The house was builded of the earth, and shall fall again to ground. Alfred Lord Tennyson, The Deserted House.
This cannot be where they live,
Lucy whispered, half in amazement, half in horror. Her mother had described Chiswick House to her once, what it had been like years ago, when Tessa had attended a ball there disguised as Jessamine. Her parents couldn't talk about the ball, in fact, without shooting each other fond, syrupy looks. It was quite disgusting. Uncle Gabriel had described the house too, in a much more exciting and suitable story about the way that he, Aunt Cecily, Uncle Jem, Lucy's parents and Uncle Gideon had dispatched the evil Benedict Lightwood, who had turned into a demonic worm and marauded through the Lightwood Gardens. It was a story with a great deal of blood and excitement, and it had been very clear, to Lucy at least, that the gardens had been glorious. The manor house itself had been glorious. White stone, spreading green lawns down to the Thames. Gorgeous Greek follies seeming to float above the ground. There had been Italian gardens and moonlight-washed balconies and tall, proud pillars. A famous reproduction of the Venus de Medici from the Uffizi galleries in Florence. A magnificent avenue of cedars sweeping up to the house. My mother said she'd heard it had fallen into disrepair, but I did not expect this, Cordelia whispered back. Her gaze, like Lucy's, was glued to the outside of the massive gates that closed off the property. Latin words were etched across the top of the ironwork. Ultima forsan. The end is closer than you think. They sent a shiver down Lucy's spine. She put her hand to her waist where her weapons belt rested. Bridget had left serif blades, belts and steelies in the carriage for them, and they had marked themselves carefully with various runes. Strength, stealth, night vision. One never could be too careful in a possibly haunted place. Lucy only wished they had been able to change into gear. They were still wearing their dresses from the picnic, torn and bloodstained. There is disrepair, and then there's disaster, Lucy said, reaching for her steely. How can Grace bear to live here? I suppose she finds other things to make her happy, Cordelia said in a subdued voice, as Lucy scratched an open rune on the gates and they swung open, scattering a powder of red rust. They stepped forward onto the broken stones and overgrowth of what had once been a gorgeous avenue lined with potted cypress and cedar trees. The rot of dying cedar filled the air now and tickled the back of Lucy's throat. The trees overhead had grown into each other, their branches tangling, bending and snapping. Dead branches littered the ground. As they came out from the avenue and into the broad circular drive in front of the house, Lucy was struck by the destroyed beauty of the manor. A double set of stairs, wonderfully constructed, led up to a broad entryway. Blackened vines twisted their way around fluted columns. If she cast her gaze up, she could see the balconies her mother had spoken of, but they had been taken over by clusters of thorns.
Like Sleeping Beauty's castle, Lucy murmured. I was just thinking that, said Cordelia. Did you ever read the older fairy tales? I remember them being much more frightening. There was one where Sleeping Beauty's palace was ringed all around with sharp briars, and the bodies of the princes who tried to get through hung on the thorns when they died, and their bones whitened in the sun. Delightful, said Lucy. I shall be sure to include that in a book. Not in the beautiful Cordelia, you won't, said Cordelia, moving up to inspect the house more closely. Lucy, there isn't a single light on, not a single bit of illumination. Maybe they are not at home. Look, there, Lucy said and pointed. I saw a light darting across one of the windows. If you do not want to knock on the door, you need not. I admit, it is quite alarming here. Cordelia squared her shoulders. I am not alarmed. Lucy hid a smile. Then I am going to seek a ghost while you distract the inhabitants. We will meet back at the gates in a quarter hour. Cordelia nodded and began to climb the cracked marble steps to the front door. The sound of her knocking faded as Lucy slipped around the house to the back, where the grass sloped down toward the dark water of the river. She found herself looking up at the stone wall of the manor, cracked with age and veined through with a million thick and twisting vines. Lucy took a running jump and seized the vines.
She began to climb quickly, hand over hand, the way she had always climbed the rope in the training room, hoping to find an open window she could climb through. To her delight, halfway up the wall she realized she had reached a balcony. Even better. Lucy pulled herself up and over the balcony railing and tumbled onto the ground. She leaped up before any of the thorny briars could penetrate her cloak and give her a nasty scratch. She felt terribly pleased with herself. She wondered if her father would have been proud if he'd known how handily she'd climbed the wall. Probably not, she had to conclude. Probably he simply would have been murderous that she was here at all. Parents really were unable to see what their children could accomplish, alas. Lucy reached for the handle of the cracked French doors, their glass smeared with black dirt and greenish rot. She pushed inward. The door flew open, showing a massive, empty ballroom beyond. Well, nearly empty. Jesse Blackthorne stood in front of her, his green eyes blazing with rage.
"What in Raziel's name are you doing here?" he hissed.
The Shadow Realm was piercingly cold. James had never felt the chill before. He had always stood somehow apart from the dark place. But now he was within. It was no longer silent, either. He could hear wind blowing and a distant sound like shattering glass. All around him there was blowing dust. Perhaps this place had once been an ocean and had dried up, blowing away with the harsh wind. Certainly there seemed nothing in front of him but an endless sea of sand. He turned, wondering if he could see any path back to the ballroom. To his surprise, he saw instead the skyline of London, the dome of St. Paul's, the crenellations of the Tower of London, and the familiar arches of Tower Bridge. Tower Bridge itself seemed to glow eerily red. James coughed. There was dust in his mouth, bitter as salt. Bitter as salt. He knelt down and scooped a handful of the bone-coloured dirt of this world into his hand. He had never been able to touch anything here before, but the dirt was solid, dusty like any other dirt. He slid a handful into his trouser pocket and rose to his feet as the vision of London faded. There was only darkness around him now, lit by a faint, eerie glow whose source he could not see. Trackless waste led in all directions. He tried to push down his rising terror, the part of him that said he would die here, in utter darkness, frozen to the spot with no path to follow. And then he saw it, a tiny flicker of golden firefly light in the distance. He moved toward it, slowly at first, and then faster as the light became a blaze. The cold began to vanish, and the scent of living things surrounded him, roots and leaves and flowers, as he stepped back into the world again. Cordelia had almost given up knocking when the front doors of Chiswick House finally swung open. Grace stood on the threshold. Much to Cordelia's surprise, she was alone. Ladies did not open their own front doors. Servants performed that task. But then, what ordinary human being, even one with the sight, would be willing to work in such a place? No wonder Grace had insisted she be picked up and dropped off at the gates. Grace was wearing the same dress she'd worn to the picnic earlier, though the hem was torn and it was stained with grass. Not that Cordelia minded. There was something humanizing about Grace exhibiting even small imperfections. Grace carried a fiery torch in her right hand. Behind her, the foyer of the house was dark. There was a dank smell in the air. Grace stared at Cordelia, her expression caught between blankness and surprise. Miss Carter.